For this week's episode of the Future Car Podcast, we're veering slightly off course from our Women Driving the Future series to bring you a very special bonus episode. Visualize this for a minute. The shine off your British Racing Green sports car after you just finished waxing the hood. The roar of a V8 revving at a stoplight about to turn green, or the wind blowing through your hair, top down, warm summer afternoon, just driving for the sake of driving, or the sound of that chirp from your wheels as you're hugging the exit ramp while imagining you're driving in the Indy 500. How's that make you feel? If you're on the edge of your seat right now, itching to get your keys and take your baby for a spin, you might be what they call a car girl or a car guy. And your typical car guy or girl is probably not looking forward to our driverless future. How are you going to truly experience a road in a living room on wheels? How will you get that thrill that a windy mountain road provides? What if your kids and your grandkids never even experience what it's like to be behind the wheel? Luckily, there are those leading the automotive industry to a sustainable future that also believe that all you car guys and girls are here to stay. Welcome to the Future Car Podcast. I'm your host, Ed Bernardin, VP of Strategic Automotive Initiatives here at Siemens Digital Industry Software. And today, we talked to a very special guest, designer legend and chairman and CEO of Fisker Inc., Henrik Fisker. He is not only a world-renowned designer that was named one of the 10 greatest designers of all time, having designed everything from luxury sports cars like the BMW Z8, Aston Martin DB9, but he's also an EV pioneer and entrepreneur aiming to make a more sustainable world for all of us. Henrik and I discuss the origins of his passion for beautiful cars and how he got to where he is today, the importance of women leading Fisker and our industry, the role of the car guy in the complex ecosystem of a driverless world. And if you stick around until the end, you'll learn what Henrik did to avoid being late to his first day on the job when we dive into his craziest speeding ticket story ever. Welcome to the show, Henrik.
Good to be here, Ed.
And how did you realize you finally were ready to become a car designer?
You know, I was sitting in the back seat of my father's old Saab 96, which were, I don't know, from the 60s, I think, early 70s. And I was probably about 10 years old or something. And I saw this Maserati Bora zipping by, and it looked like a spaceship at that time. And I just thought, I want to design cars. I want to do something with cars. And many years later, in Denmark, I grew up in Denmark. There was no car industry, no car designers. So eventually I kept drawing cars, you know, in school instead of doing my homework. And I then took a sort of an exam as a technical draftsman, still drew cars at that first job I got. And my dad finally said, why don't you write a letter to Volvo? So I wrote a letter to Volvo, and they recommended the American School Art Center College of Design, which at that time had a branch in Switzerland. So I threw all my drawings in my old rusty car and drove down and got accepted. And then I became a car designer and started at BMW in 1989.
Now, you were named one of the 10 greatest car designers in automotive history. I'm sure you probably know most of the names that are on that list. Who do you admire most?
My real inspiration sort of growing up in the 70s of car design was Giugiaro, Giorgetto Giugiaro. Etel design and all that. And that's because
he's number one on the list, in fact, right?
Yeah. And I think he is number one. You know, he did everything from amazing concept cars to actual production supercars, all the way to designing the very first Volkswagen Golf, which I think to this date might still be one of the most sold vehicles ever. And that was an amazing span to have. And when you look at the Volkswagen Golf when it came out first, it was really radical. It was the first sort of boxy, sort of cool-looking city car. And, you know, then he's, of course, done tons of Maseratis and other amazing vehicles in his time. But I really admire him a lot. Yeah, he's number one.
Now, they say there's two kinds of people in the world, Italians and people that want to be Italian. Do you think if you were born Italian, it would have improved your ability to design?
Well, look, I think I would have got into car design quicker, you know, and maybe I would have got that job in Italy. You know, when I was getting, when I was looking for my first job after Ascend, I actually took my Alfa Romeo and drove over the Alps. I studied in Switzerland and drove down for an interview at Alfa Romeo. I really wanted to work at Alfa Romeo, but I ended up at BMW simply because, you know, they were paying in lira at the time, and I wouldn't even have been able to pay back my student loan with the salary they offered me. So I ended up with BMW instead, but no regrets there, but if I lived in Italy, it might have been easier. But I love Italian food, love Italian design, no doubt about it.
When it comes to design, there's always a tension, right, between engineering and styling. And now, of course, you're running a company, so there's also financial responsibilities. As you're trying to maintain this balance between all of those, do you think that it's made you more conservative in design or changed the way you look at design?
No. So I think what happened in the car industry, it's almost become too well an oiled industry where the way we engineer, design, and develop cars today, and we meaning the entire car industry, has been almost perfected so much that we can't seem to get out of our own way. We can't think out of the box. And I saw that when I worked for several, of course, of the large OEMs. And in one hand, it means that if you work for one of those large OEMs, it's very hard to make a mistake. You know, most of the cars are pretty good, even if they're not amazing. However, it also means that you have a very hard time innovating, specifically if it comes to design and proportions of a vehicle, because the way vehicles were designed in the 50s and 60s, it started out with a great idea, and then the engineers try to make that idea dream into reality. Today, the way you design a car is engineering give you a package that's been specified by a whole bunch of basically feedback from marketing and everybody else, and a lot of times even the prior car, how it was. So the restrictions for a designer is so tight these days, which is why you have proportions of a sedan in a certain price class looking exactly the same, being within millimeters of size. So at Fisker Inc., we're taking a completely different view. We are in the very beginning, we have a unique design process, which we call FFPAD, which stands for Fisker Flexible Platform Adaptive Design. So we actually work with a very small engineering group and myself in design and a couple of UX, so user experience researchers, et cetera. And we come up with a new concept of how we want this design. And it's a very different way, a much faster way, but also a more pure way to design a car. So we kind of try to avoid this classic fight when a designer wants the engineers to change that package they've given you and spent several years on working on. And now the design wants to change to 10 millimeter and you're fighting and you win with 7 millimeter. So we're trying to avoid that sort of whole fight, at least within Fisker Inc.
It's almost a battle of passion versus cost versus, you know, engineering logic, right? I mean, as a designer, obviously there's passion in those curves and the lines that you see.
Yeah, I mean, look, unless you're a pure artist and you're doing a painting, which I do once in a while, you know, there's no restrictions on that other than the size of the painting or whatever the canvas you chose. But in this case, when you make a product, any type of product, it's always a compromise between several functions, and that's design, aesthetics, cost, function itself, functionality, technology. You know, you're packaging all this in one bundle. And, you know, one of the best examples, I guess, we always use as where probably one of the most perfect packagings of design and technology and user interface was, of course, the original iPhone. And that's, I think, always the symbol that we use to say that's when everything comes together perfectly. I don't know what fights that went on with Steve Jobs back in the day, probably a lot. The key is, can you make the right decisions? And there is no formula for the right decision because you really don't know how a consumer is going to react truly until this product's on the market, except if you're doing a historical rework of a product. And most cars today are historical reworks. So if BMW is making a new BMW 3 Series, I'm just using an example, they're using last generation 3 Series as the starting point of where to improve stuff. 5 millimeters.
That constrains you, right?
Yeah, but if you, of course, make a brand new vehicle, now you're much more free. And now you're in a risky area where nobody really knows what's going to happen. And that's kind of where we are with the electric vehicle revolution today, because there is very little historical data of successful electric vehicles.
If you had to make a pie chart now and you had to split it between of Henry Fisker, what percent is designer, what percent is engineer, and what percent is businessman?
You know, I'm still, I would say I'm still 60%, 70% designer, and then the rest is businessman, entrepreneur. I surround myself with some really amazing people, specifically on the financial side. Also, you need amazing engineers. We got an amazing CTO, an amazing senior VP of engineering. I worked with our senior VP of engineering all the way back at Aston Martin days. So he really understands what is needed to create a beautiful design. Because, you know, it's also a huge effort from an engineering point of view to end up with a fantastic design. It actually demands a lot of innovation, a lot of collaboration between design and engineering. Right now, for instance, we are trying to invent some unique structures in the front crash area to get the short overhang that I want. So it's rather than a fight, it's become a collaboration to make an innovation where we can stand apart from any other product. So that's something where, in my view, to truly create a great car design that is functional, that's not just a show car, you've got to have engineering and design working very closely together. Now, of course, it helps that I have the final say in the company.
Of course, so you're the boss, right?
It sways a bit towards the design, but that's one of our key brand pillars is design. So if you know that's what we are, what we want to lead in. So that's I think our main differentiator.
If we take design and we start to look at where it's headed, and you just mentioned that as a result of you're not forced to conform to a previous platform, do you think in the next 5-10 years that design is going to automotive design will consolidate or it'll diversify? And I want to bring out a couple of examples that so-called futuristic cars, like Apple showed their, I guess you could call it their future autonomous car, very angular, reminded me a lot of the Cybertruck. And when I look at it, I say, oh, well, it's futuristic, but is it stylish? So where do you think styling is going in the year 2030 and beyond?
So I think the industry right now is in a big sort of turmoil because everybody knows that we're in for some dramatic changes that could cost maybe even some companies their life if they don't do it right. And it's that conversion of technology and design. And the reason these two elements is shooting in the forefront is because as we move away from the gasoline engine into electrification, the classic brand values of many traditional car companies are falling away, where it used to be whoever made a great engine or a great gearbox, they would, you know, lead the segment. Now, that's not going to be the case in the future because electric motors and you know, no transmission really means, or no gear change really means that that's almost a zero differentiation there. So I believe design and software is going to be the number two main points in the future that's going to drive the success of a car company. Now, between software and design comes then the merging of those two, and that's the user interface, which is going to be incredibly important in the future. So there's three aspects. You've got the hardware design, which is exterior and interior. That's going to be even more important in the future. Then you've got the software that basically drives the car in terms of the feeling and the character of the car. And then you've got the user interface, which is a combination of the two, because you've got to design that user interface, both in terms of how it looks and how it functions. Now, where is design going and why do you have these kind of crazy concepts out there right now? It's because people, you know, companies are trying to get attention and companies are trying to figure out, you know, what is going to drive the consumer. I personally believe that consumers in the future are really going to look for beauty in their vehicles.
You're still going to like those soft flowing lines, even if it's, but yet futuristic at the same time, right?
So I think the word futuristic doesn't necessarily mean for me that it's just different and shocks you. I think futuristic is about coming up with something better than the past. That for me is a futuristic design. So it is modern, it's new, but it's got to be something that emotionally draws you to say, wow, I want to be part of this future. Not just shocking you and go, oh, it's the future. Do I really want to go there? Maybe not. So for me, it's about wanting to go into the future, take the customers with you. And that, you know, everybody loves beauty. It doesn't matter where you are in the world, who you are, what religion. everybody gets drawn to a beautiful, beautiful car. And that's something that I think is actually not going to disappear, but it's going to be even more important in the future as we walk down the value chain and in the vehicles.
A couple of years ago, Bob Lutz, your partner from VLF Automotive, he actually gave a talk here at IESF. And one of the things he said is that the brand is disappearing. And as Bob Lutz said, in the future, what's happening inside the car and the styling inside the car, the experience inside the car is going to be more important and maybe the only thing that's important. Do you see that happening? And if that's the case, how does it change what designers and engineers have to do?
You know, I see it a little different. I think what's going to happen in the future, and I really think it's sprung out of ride hailing. And as soon as we get out of COVID, you know, we're going to see an uptick in ride hailing again and probably car sharing. And I think what's going to happen, in my view, just very roughly, we're going to see the mobility segment move into or shape itself into two fundamental directions. One is the word mobility. I need mobility. I need to go somewhere now, immediately, in the easiest way. And for that, we are going to have a multiple versions of some sort of ride hailing, easy access. And there, it's all going to be about the ease of use, the fast digital experience, get this mobility quickly, and then, of course, the interior and the comfort and everything else. But I can tell you, I do not believe that generally people are willing to give up their private car. However, they might own that. It may be a flexible lease like ours, but you know, they feel they own their car. And when you own something, when it's yours, then you want it to reflect your personality, your desires, what you like. That's why we're not all running around in a blue jumpsuit that could be made much cheaper than our special made clothes. So therefore, car design in those areas will still be about the exterior first. You walk up, you see a car, and you're just not going to plunge down $50,000 on an ugly car because it's got a beautiful interior. I don't believe that. And why would you? If somebody else can offer you a beautiful exterior and a beautiful interior, why not have both?
I've got to ask you this, but the first car from your company was the Karma. How did you come up with that name?
You know, I was sitting one night and reading. Actually, I took the Italian dictionary, and because most cool car names are Italian, and I went through it and I looked through all of them. Every time I found a cool name, it meant something, you know, like toilet paper or something else, whatever it was. that wasn't really
that
cool.
That's all that in Italy then.
In the meaning. It sounded really cool in Italian, but when you translated it, it wasn't. And I had sat for hours, and it was late at night, and I was so tired, and I just picked up a magazine. And there happened to be a story about good karma. And I thought, you know, we're making this world's first truly sustainable vehicle with reclaimed wood and vegan interior, solar roof. And I thought, it's really good karma if you buy it. So why don't we call it Karma? I mean, I just came in next morning. I said, we're calling the car
Fisker. That's it.
Karma. There was no committee. There was no nothing. And that's what we called it. And, you know, we'll make a successor to that car as well. That would be one of the future models we come out with, because it's obviously dear to my heart. It was super radical at the time. And, you know, now when you make something that's that radical, it's always hard to beat it. But we're going to try and beat it. And we showed an emotion show car. We'll do another version of that. And that will be sort of the spiritual successor to the Fisker Karma.
I read that when you were first selling the car and getting it out there, you actually had lunch with a lot of your customers. And two categories, like Leonardo DiCaprio, Ashton Kutcher. So you've got actors, and then you've got Al Gore, Colin Powell, you got politicians. Is it easier to sell a car to an actor or a politician?
You don't sell cars to actors. They get them for free. Well, I will tell you,
politicians.
Actually, Leo and everybody did buy the car. So, but I would tell you that, I mean, you can structure these things different, an investment, then you get a car, whatever. I mean, we were very smart about all that we couldn't afford to give a ton of cars away. But I will tell you this. Out of the about over 2,000 people who bought the Fisker Karma, I have at least spoken to thousands of them. I remember sitting down for days, and we called each customer. I mean, some didn't pick up, and I just called them because we had the software issue and we had a lot of complaints. So I wanted to call people personally, and I think I called about 50 to 100 people a day, and just saying, "Hey, we're trying to fix it. Have some patience." That's one of the tough things when you're out that early. We were so early out. And you have to remember, we launched the Fisker Karma 1.5 year before the Tesla Model S was launched. So we were super early with this new software, touchscreen, batteries. And, you know, we got punished for being that early. But now we're back and we have a lot of lessons learned. And I think the time is so different now where electrification has been cemented now. It's coming. We are transitioning into full electric. And that will have a huge impact on design, specifically in the next generation of cars, because pretty much all vehicles will have the battery in the floor, and that will change the proportions. We can't anymore make these super low sedans that we could in the past. So that will fundamentally change proportions of vehicle as we move forward.
Certainly, you must have learned some lessons with the Fisker Karma. I mean, there were the court battles you had early on with Tesla and Aston Martin, and then later as part of Karma, of course, advanced technology, vehicle manufacturing loans and all that, testifying before Congress. What are the big lessons you learned that are helping you, you know, make sure that you do things in the best way moving forward?
Well, you know, some of the things were things that simply were not available in, even in hindsight. So let's say we had a battery maker, A123. Which, of course, today you could say, well, why didn't you take CATL? Well, because it didn't exist. So reality is that back in the day when Tesla and Fisker started and the third one that made electric vehicles with GM, each one had their battery maker. So Tesla had Panasonic and GM had LG Chem, and I believe that exclusive with them for several years, so we couldn't get a hold of them. And then we had A123, a small American startup. And of course, they ended up going bankrupt as we launched our car. So in hindsight, the only thing we could have done is say we were going to wait a year or two to launch it. But obviously, we weren't going to do that. So we took a big risk there. Today, we don't have that technology risk because we got proven technology. So I would say one of the lessons learned is take less technology risk with your first product if it's not necessary, if it's not a key part of what you're doing. And so today, obviously, that's a lot easier than it was back in the day. Secondly, if I could avoid it, I would probably never take a government loan, especially because, as we see, you alienate certain customers from your customer list if they don't approve of you know, governments giving loans, et cetera. And secondly, it's just a very difficult thing to be part of. I think it was done in good effort, and I think governments should be involved in promoting green technology, but maybe in different ways necessarily than giving loans. There's, you know, tax incentives on buying vehicles and other smart ways to do these things. And then third, I think that, you know, when you're in such a revolutionary, I would say, market where, you know, you're up against conglomerates. I mean, you look at the automotive industry, it's a multi-trillion dollar industry that is sort of supported by the oil industry. So you got two multi-trillion dollar industries, and there was two small companies, Tesla and Fisker, that went up against it. And that means that you can't underestimate that the wave of general negativity you have against you, even from supposedly independent observers, media, et cetera, was enormous at the time for both Fisker and Tesla, if you remember. So that was something that probably, again, today, there's much less of that. I think there is opinion at the time, I think, from the general media that, you know, neither Tesla or Fisker would ever made it. And you know, we didn't, but now we're back with a vengeance, maybe. So, you know, we it was tough at the time, but it was a lot of good lessons learned. We have built our entire business model around the lessons learned, being asset light, partnering up with Magna, the world's third largest automotive supplier. They're taking a 6% stake in Fisker. You know, we have done asset light, a digital car company with a whole new flexible lease model. So there were so many of these things we took in that I would never have been able to come up with these ideas if I hadn't tried it the hard way first. In my view, you learn more from failure than success.
Well, you mentioned asset light, which is really interesting, right? And certainly what you're doing with Magna Steyr definitely represents that. Why create another automotive car factory when there's plenty of them to go around? But the approach you took, even with the Karma, was along those lines, right? Where you had a lot of suppliers working for you. It's different than the approaches, say, that Tesla took. They developed everything more on their own. Do you think it's important to own all the technology that's in your car? What's the balance between asset light and, let's call it, technology light?
I wouldn't compare these two. Asset light meaning that you decide that certain commodities is not necessary. Now, when we did
the commodity versus technology then.
Exactly. So when we did Fisker Karma originally, we did do a car from ground up. We did not use a platform from anybody. We put a team together from ground up, and we went through all the same difficulties, whether we had outsourced the manufacturing or not, that Tesla went through. I mean, Tesla has taken many, many years to manufacture a car. Elon has been pretty open about manufacturing hell, et cetera. For me, this time around, it was not important for me to prove to anybody I can manufacture a car. You know, just like I have never seen Tim Cook walk down a manufacturing floor bragging about how good he is to make the iPhone, because he doesn't make it. It's made by Foxconn. Right. So we have taken that model. That doesn't mean Apple doesn't own its own technologies and doesn't create a ton of IP, make an operating system, do great design. That's the way I look at it, that we will be owning a lot of our technology, what we feel is important. There's certain technologies that I think are commodities. I don't need to own the development of an air condition. That's technology. I don't need to own some other areas. Like at the moment, we have done a lot of battery research. You talked about it. And we figured out that, you know, with all the research we have done, there is no solid state battery technology coming around the corner. It's too difficult. It's too hard to scale up. So therefore, we know that we're going to be living with lithium-ion batteries for a long time, and we don't need to own the cell manufacturing of that at this point in time. I'd rather be open to use different battery technologies when they improve slightly, and also be able to package my battery so if one battery manufacturer can't supply enough, I can use somebody else. And then finally, you got into the IP of the software. Yes, we will be building our own chips one day. We can't afford and have time to do that right now. But yes, we definitely will do. We will own all our own software in terms of how you interact with the car, the battery management system, everything else. Like I mentioned earlier, that's important. Design, of course, we own that. Do I need to stamp the aluminum platform? No. Do I need to make my own steering rack? No. And by the way, even if you're fully vertically integrated, most car companies, they don't make their own steering racks. They don't make their own brakes. They don't make their own air conditioning. That is outsourced to these large commodity suppliers today. And that's, we are just doing a little further. We are sharing a platform with another OEM that we then modify to our specifications, but it allows us to get a vehicle to market in record time in about 2 years, which nobody else can do. And secondly, it takes hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions out of development because we are sharing it with somebody else. And then finally, because we are sharing so many components, we immediately have volume when we launch the vehicle so we can then price it like nobody else. I mean, I don't know what other cool SUV that's out there for $37,500. And I think that's going to be a unique selling point for us when we start delivering it.
Well, so like you say, you want to keep control of the key technologies like batteries and that type of thing. And certainly, I have to compliment you on the Ocean. That is one beautiful car. And the price is even more beautiful than the car itself. The leasing program seems quite unique, where, well, I think it's like almost $3,000 down and then $379 per month, return it at any time. It almost seems overly generous. I mean, what drove you to that program?
Well, the first thing that drew me to the program was that I think we have a new generation of young people, which I kind of call the non-committal generation. They don't want to necessarily go out and take a loan for $40,000 and pay it over 7 years. I don't think they really want to lease a car for 3 or 4 years and be stuck with it. And so we kind of thought, how can we get them into a super sustainable car, a vehicle they like, without having to do this commitment? Now, of course, you also have to make business sense. So the reason I think no other traditional car company can do this lease model is because it means that you have to have an incredible lean setup to make this work financially. And that has to go through the entire organization, even to how you build the car, how you deliver the car, how you service the car. So to give you two examples, we don't have any dealers, so we have no dealer margin. That's the first thing. Secondly, we go one step further than Tesla that builds their own dealerships for service. We don't build dealerships for service. We have outsourced our service. We have signed contracts. We're in the middle of signing contracts in Europe as well. We have already done here in the U.S. MOU so far. And what we are going to do is outsource service. We'll pick up the car, services, and give it back to you. All done digitally, digitally key, coming, picking up the car and all that. So we have basically taken so much cost out of owning and servicing this car that we are able to create this lease program Then it needs to go one step further. You need to design a car that you think is going to look awesome in 3, 4, or 5 years from now. A car that's going to be timeless, that doesn't have too much clutter. So if you look at the Ocean, it doesn't have all these sort of, you know, folding lines coming down through the side and the upper body and all kind of, you know, funky stuff on it. It has super thin lights that I think is going to be futuristic looking in 5 years from now as well. So by doing all that and then having over-the-air upgrades, so we can upgrade the car with software, we believe that this car will look great in 5 years, so we can keep leasing it out, not for the same price, for a lower price, but if we can maintain a fairly good price level over, you know, a certain amount of years, we end up making more money on this vehicle than you would do by a one-time sale. And we have a reoccurring revenue. And don't forget, because we don't have dealers, it's lower cost for us to maintain this vehicle than it would be for you or anybody else leasing a normal car and going to a dealer to get it serviced.
So run your company efficiently, have great styling, you can lower the price, and everybody is going to want to buy your cars, it sounds like, right?
That's pretty much it.
Now, you have several models in the pipeline in addition to the Ocean. When are they coming out?
We are planning to launch at least 4 vehicles before 2025. Obviously, the platform we are launching the Ocean on is a pretty flexible platform that we really have tailored to work for several fiscal models in the future. But we are also platform agnostic in the sense that we are already talking to several other large car makers about sharing platforms. I think platform sharing is going to be very common in the future as we move into electrification, because the way for several groups to get volume and sharing components, sharing investment, because we need to funnel more money over towards technology than we have had to do in the past. So we need to take money out somewhere, and you can do that by sharing platform. Now, when it comes to what vehicles, definitely the a version of the Emotion, like I said, will come out. We haven't put a timeline on it. We have also not put a timeline on the others because we're still sort of moving a little bit around with our product plan as we are in negotiations for the next platforms, because some of them will need a different platform than the Ocean platform. And we also want to, of course, leave some excitement, some mystery, and not give everything away to our competitors. But what I can tell you is this: the Ocean will be the least radical car. Every other car will come out will be a lot more radical in its segment than the Ocean. We will be trying to come up with at least one very strong feature that will really set our vehicles apart in the segment we're entering. In fact, if we can even sort of revive a certain segment or take a new take on a segment, we will try to do that. We don't want to make another Me Too car. You're not going to see a normal sedan from Fisker. You're not going to see a normal, you know, hatchback from Fisker. If we do something, it's going to be radically different. I think the Ocean is a new take on an SUV, looking like an SUV, but with a California mode, all the windows rolling down, the solar roof. You will see the final production model. We are showing in LA Auto Show next year. And I think you'll be surprised of the amazing proportion. It's better than any of the other two prototypes we have shown, because that will be sitting on the final platform and is actually even better than what we have shown so far. The interior is going to be even more futuristic. So I think this is going to be really a shocker when it comes out in that price segment. So we are very excited about it.
Women are playing a greater and greater role in the automotive industry. You got Mary Barr leading General Motors. You have a woman in the role of president and CFO. What do you think the positive impact on your business is of having women in such an influential position in Fisker Inc.?
So let me just add to that. We got 3 women board members. We have both our head of exterior design and interior design are women. So we have a pretty much a female-controlled design studio, except for I'm there popping in once in a while doing a sketch. But to be honest, I think it's extremely important, because in the end of the day, we are a society where women today, I think, have as much decision power and purchasing power, if not even more sometimes than men. And also, I think we are moving towards a society which is equal. We're not there yet, but I think from my view, and what has been amazing, at least at Fisker Inc., is there's so many amazing women out there, and you just gotta, you know, we hire them, we put them in, and in the right positions, they're equal pay and all this. I mean, I think that it's not such a There's nothing, I think, that needs to be unique about this. It should just happen. We shouldn't even be discussing this in the year 2020. You know, I grew up in Denmark where my mother worked her whole life and was a so-called feminist at the time. So I grew up with all that, and it's pretty natural for me. And, you know, ESG, environmental social governance, a big thing. I think young people particularly is going to choose brands they want to buy things from that fits into their beliefs and the lifestyles. And I think coming out of COVID, well, we've had a lot of time to reflect. I think these things will be even more important as we move out. But, you know, women also give different inputs on certain things than men does. And I think you need to have that tension, that discussion, that creativity to truly come out with magnificent products.
As this EV market shakes out, who do you think is going to be the winner? You've got startups, you've got traditional car companies, you've got software companies. What do you see happening here in the next 5-10 years?
So I think, you know, it's always tough to see winners and losers, but I think the winners will be coming out and be clear over the next 5 years. And I think what's going to happen on a broad picture without sort of necessarily slamming a particular company, I think what's going to happen is that you're going to, for the first time in the car industry, which sort of has stayed the same for 100 years. You know, the car industry is the only industry that really hasn't moved much as we have gone into this digital transformation. So I think in 5 years, what you're going to see is a totally different mix than we see today. You will probably see the traditional car industry shrink quite a lot, maybe even a few brands disappearing. And then you're going to see some new brands coming out, and the new brands will emerge from two sides. One will be the EV startups, and there will be few of those. 90% of the EV startups will not make it, in my view, because most of the people who's gone in there, they underestimate how difficult it is to enter this industry and what needs to be done to manufacture a vehicle in high volume. You've got traditionals, they're going to shrink. You're going to have the new EV startups, and then you're going to have the kind of technology brands that today we are not associating with cars. So you may end up having a couple of technology brands that today the consumer don't know about that will end up potentially either making a car or making a collaboration with an EV startup or a car company to make a car. I don't know if technology brands necessarily want to make their own branded cars. I mean, you have heard Foxconn wants to get in and, you know, build cars, offer skateboards, etc. But I'm not sure they want to necessarily brand a car, because once you do that, it's a whole different game. But I could see EV startups joining up with technology companies and get access to this technology and introduce new technology through a EV startup brand. You know, I could see that happening. But we will see a whole new layout of the world in 5 years. And of course, you have a lot of Chinese EV startup companies as well. And we'll have to see who makes it out of those and when do they enter the world market, the rest of the world. That'll be interesting to see how that plays out as well.
Where do you see your biggest competition coming from?
Well, you know, our biggest competition is really going to be some of the traditional luxury car makers, clearly, because that's where the market is. I mean, today, about 80 million vehicles are made globally, but only 2 million electric. So, you know, we might be an alternative to Tesla, but, you know, we don't see us taking, you know, market share away from Tesla, because we're in growth mode. So we need to get to the 78 million gasoline drivers out there and get them into an electric car.
Plenty of customers, right?
Yeah. So I see, you know, it's the traditional premium gasoline car brands. Those are our main competitors. I want to go and get customers and convince them to get into our electric cars.
If you take a step back and you look at your engineering processes, where are the biggest bottlenecks? Where are the biggest issues, you think, in engineering?
So, you know, as I mentioned, we have a different engineering development process than anybody else. We bring in marketing in a completely different way. And quite honestly, we don't really take much notice of them. I mean, I'm sorry to say it. I hope none of my marketing guys are listening in here. But marketing for me is there to market a product, not to come in and say what the product should be. And that's how we are at Fisker. And that fundamentally sets us apart, because now it becomes a creative, very fast creative process between engineering and design. And engineering is, of course, hardware and software engineering. So, you know, we know already we can't make a car without an airbag, or we can't make a car without a front crash structure. So let's not start with a concept where there isn't a front crash structure. We immediately go in and make sure that that's there. So it's a different process. So now the engineers are concentrating on innovating in other areas of the vehicle. And so same with software. But if I'm talking about the biggest risk in car making in the future is clearly software. It's the biggest bottleneck. It's where you have to spend the most work. It's the most risk. It's also sometimes the easiest to fix.
So here's your chance. I got to ask you the autonomous car question. You know, it goes like this. Oh, when are we going to have autonomous cars? Now, it's a hard question to answer because does that mean 10% of the cars are 30 or 40? But when do you think that autonomous cars and shuttles or whatever it might be are going to play an important part in our lives?
Let me first say this. There is a person somewhere in the middle of America working for a minimum wage, driving maybe 25, 30 miles to work every day. That person probably bought maybe a F-150 pickup truck for $1,000 that is 20 years old. Now, that person will also exist in 20 years. So that person will buy a 2020 whatever car that is not autonomous, which means 20 years from now, not all cars will be fully autonomous.
So that means if you lived in a city, say, you live in an urban city and
you can't forbid people to drive into the city. So I think reality is you're going to have a mix of vehicles for at least the next 25 years. A mix.
But even now, though, you can't go out and hop in an autonomous car. I mean, autonomous cars are practically no use to us, right? There's just enough of them out there.
I think so. My view on autonomous cars is the following. I mean, level 5 means anywhere, at any time, any place, and all that.
That's a long ways away, right?
That, I don't even know when that is. I don't even want to predict it. For sure, it's more than 10 years away. Now, but between that and where we are today, there are, of course, several levels of autonomy. We looked at this autonomous shuttle, and the reason was that you can put that into some closed areas where, for instance, you don't have children and animals running around. So, for instance, we were thinking airports between terminals,
being your orbit could work there, right?
Yeah, the orbit could work, that it can be deployed. You have big campuses where you only have grown-ups working and all that type of stuff, low speed. So I think we're going to end up seeing some form of mobility being autonomous, maybe within 3-4 years. Then I think when it comes to passenger cars, you're not going to see a passenger car for sure in the next 10 years that you can buy as a private person without a steering wheel. Now, what you may see is certain conditions where I believe we can go fully autonomous. So if you're in stop and go traffic on the freeway, there is no kids running over the road in the freeway. So we should be able to take a little bit of risk there that even if it wouldn't work and you're driving 20 miles an hour, 15 miles an hour in stop and go traffic, even if you do have a fender bender, it's not going to be detrimental. So therefore, I could see you reading the newspaper on the way to work, sitting in stop-and-go traffic in some years to come, maybe in a few years. But we have to distinguish between driving in a city where a child can suddenly jump in front of a car and then sitting on a freeway in stop-and-go traffic. So I think you're going to see different technology deployed at different times. And that's also why the idea of having these sort of little autonomous shuttles in the city is really cool. The problem is we do have children running around the city. And that's the issue, that if somebody jumps in front of a shuttle where there's no driver and they get killed and there's nobody to come out and help that kid and do something, that I don't think we want to see that. So that's why I see the issue. And then there's the simple issue of driving behind a FedEx truck on a one-lane street and that stops to drop off a package for 20 minutes. Well, if I'm in my normal car, I break the law and I go around it. Even if a police car would be behind me, he would say, okay. But if I have an autonomous car, do I want to program that to break the law? And what if somebody gets killed and it's breaking the law? Those are the issues that we have to figure out.
Yeah. Do we want autonomous cars acting like people? I don't know. That could be dangerous, right? There's some dangerous people out there, I imagine. Well, listen, I want to ask you, you're a car guy. You must be a car guy, I would think, right? Your whole life's been around cars. What's going to happen to the car guy, right? I mean, certainly there's still going to be racetracks and things like that. But even the nature of racing is changing. You've got Formula E. It doesn't have the sound that, Formula One has or whatever. And then there's also, I saw you've been looking into Extreme E, which is trying to take the reputation of racing, which some might say is not sustainable, but try and convert that into using racing and motorsports to promote sustainability. Do you think that's where racing is headed? Because it sounds like a great combination.
Look, I'm a supercar guy, and I am going to fight for the car guys until I die. I will always make cool, fun cars, absolutely. That's what we're about at Fisker Inc. And I think even when we go electric, we can have them be cool and fun. And by the way, the Fisker Karma, I think we're the first vehicle to have a cool sound. We will have a super cool sound as well. The latest gasoline cars today, they have enhanced sounds from sound systems. So we're already in that direction. I think cars, gasoline cars, will be like horses. You know, nobody rides a horse to work, but they take it, maybe go to the races on the weekend. And to be honest, let's not go overboard here. I mean, if we only have car racing with gasoline vehicles, it would have zero impact on our planet in terms of pollution. Because those few cars driving around the racetrack really would have no effect at all. So I think we also have to be a little forgiving here and find some way. Just like, look, yes, is vegan interiors great? Of course we have vegan interiors in our vehicles, but that mean I never eat a steak? Of course I eat a steak. I love steak. But you don't have to have a steak every day. Just like, you know, you once in a while you have a glass of wine or a martini or whatever. You know, I think we need to have a fun life and be able to live, but it doesn't mean we can't improve our life. And I think we have to realize that electric vehicles are going to have one of the biggest impact on our planet. If we can make our daily commute being that electric vehicle, it'll be huge. So that will happen, but we can still be car guys. We can still have cool cars. I think Extreme E is fantastic, specifically because it's off-road and they clean up after and all that. And they're partly there to promote sustainability. But I also think it's going to be a super fun race. If it's not fun, nobody's going to look at it.
Right.
So, you know, the reason electric vehicles never took off in the early days is because they were small and ugly. And you can't force people to do, like, nobody would eat kale unless somebody put a sauce on it. Let's face it, it doesn't taste good. So, you know, you got to make the salad taste good.
The Prius needs some sauce then, right? Is that what you're saying? Well, listen, Henrik, thank you so much for everything here. I want to finish things out with what we call rapid fire. Series of questions, real quick. The first ones are about cars, right, or car related. And then we'll just jump into some more general ones. If you're ready to go, I'm going to shoot them at you. If you want to give me a quick answer, it's fine. You want to go a little longer, that's fine too. You want to pass, that's okay as well. But I'm sure a guy like you is not going to pass. I'm almost sure.
I'm ready to go.
Ready to go? All right. What's the first car you ever bought?
Alfa Romeo Alfa Sud 1.2.
Did you name it?
No, I didn't. I just called Alfa my Alfa.
Did you pass your driver's test on the first try?
Yes, I did.
What's the first drive you took once you passed it?
I took my dad's Saab 96 and it was snowing and I thought I really knew how to drive and I ended up in a ditch and I didn't dare call him. So I saw a tractor and I asked the guy if he could pull me out and he did.
And your dad let you drive it a second time after that?
He said, this time you better go really slow.
Okay. Do you like to drive fast or slow?
I do like to drive fast, unfortunately.
You ever gotten a speeding ticket?
Too many times.
Tell me your best speeding ticket story.
Well, the best one was when I just started Aston Martin. I was going to meet the boss there the first time, and they had given me an Aston Martin to drive. And I confused the M40 with the M4 in England. It was in England, of course. And I realized I was the wrong way, but I calculated if I would do an average speed of 160 miles an hour, I could make it. So I went like a crazy man, drove about 180 miles an hour, got under a bridge. And there was nobody, by the way, on the freeway. It was sort of at 10 in the morning, far out. And I saw this car on top of the freeway, and it came obviously down and was a police car. But I was going so fast that it couldn't catch me. So by the time I got to Aston Martin, I was suddenly behind a big farmer's sort of a tractor. And he finally caught up with me, stopped me. And said, you know, you went like crazy, you know, you, and he was yelling and screaming. And I said, look, it's my first day and all that. He actually told me I had to go to court. And he said, you have to be driven to court because he was so sure I'm going to take my driver license. But I did, when I spoke to the judge, which of course were the three judges in England with the wigs, I said, look, it was my first day. I made a mistake. I made sure now that my assistant will plan in an extra half an hour to go to work every day. And they went out for deliberation, came back and said, you know what, if you can pay £300, fine, we'll let you keep the license. So that was probably my best story because I was really, really nervous I was going to lose my license there because it was kind of a crazy drive.
If you could only own one more car for the rest of your life, and it can't be one that you've made, it could be one that you designed if you want, what car would it be?
If it can't be one that I made, because it would have been the Fisker Karma. Then
I guess probably, right. It can't be a Karma or the Ocean or any of the ones that are about to come out. It has to be anything else.
It's a hard one, but I probably would say the BMW Z8 then.
Oh, that's a beautiful car. If you could eliminate one car from ever having been on the planet Earth, which one would it be?
Well, I was going to say one from a very big car brand, but I might want to do a business deal in the future. So let me tell you.
It's a hard one to answer. It's a hard one.
Let me tell you one that doesn't exist anymore. The Pontiac Aztec, I think, is a classic one, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Oh, my God, especially for you with all those angles and sharp. Oh, my God. Perfect answer. Perfect answer. If you had an autonomous car that was a living room on wheels, right? So you've got this little living room that you're in. What would your living room on wheels be for that 5-hour trip? What would you want in it?
I would want a super cool, relaxing chair, a giant screen, and then I would want my drawing board so I could sit and make some great sketches. And I probably would like to have a restroom in there as well if it's that many hours, and a fridge.
What person, living or not, would you want to spend that 5-hour car ride with?
My wife.
Which person that's ever lived would you least want to spend that car ride with?
Probably Genghis Khan or somebody like that, right?
Oh, there you go. All right. What's your favorite feature in a car, in the interior of a car?
Favorite feature in the interior of a car is probably the steering wheel.
Your favorite iconic car scene from a movie?
Bullet is probably one of the best, but I also really like Ronin with De Niro when they were driving up in the end where they were shooting from the Mercedes and they were in, I think, in a Citroen. There was some pretty great car scene up there in the French mountains. Ronin, I probably put Ronin up there.
What car best describes your personality?
The Fisker Karma.
If you hadn't become a car designer, what would you have done professionally?
I think architect.
All right. Now we get to a little bit more general questions here. How do you relax? What do you do to relax?
I sketch cars.
What hobby do you have that has nothing to do with your work? This is a little tougher, and I can't say sketch cars, I guess.
If you can call a hobby, maybe watching action movies.
What's your favorite movie or TV show of all time?
I think it's James Bond is probably my favorite. Goldfinger.
What do you wish you were better at?
Math.
What do you usually eat for breakfast?
I just have a coffee. A bulletproof coffee.
Favorite city?
Los Angeles.
If you could magically invent one thing, what would it be?
That would be probably a television which would just understand that you want to find your an action movie and which channel to go to.
Maybe get rid of all the commercials, of course. Right?
Maybe something via your brainwaves that you could just immediately find the right channel or the right movie or the right program.
So what would you uninvent?
So what I would uninvent is probably, let's say, the gasoline engine.
Oh, there you go. Hey, well, listen, thank you so much. That was great.
Thank you, guys.
Talking to you, and you design some really, really beautiful cars. I just had to say, I always thought the Z8 was like the ultimate. I wish I could have afforded it when it came out. But
I know. Now it's even more expensive.
Again, thanks to Henrik for joining us today on the Future Car Podcast, and a big thank you, as always, to all our listeners, especially our new listeners that joined us for the first time this past year. We were able to bring a lot of different folks into the discussions about the future of mobility, and certainly our Women Driving the Future series was a unique viewpoint that really broadened the discussion. We're all looking forward to starting another exciting year of podcasts in 2021, so please stay safe. Stay healthy and have a happy new year. And as always, for more information about Siemens Digital Industry Software, make sure to visit us at plm.automation.siemens.com. And until next year, I'm Ed Bernardin, and this has been the Future Car Podcast.